When we look at the desert, a desert is something that's classified as a place that doesn't receive a lot of rain. You know, something like less than 16 inches per year would be classified as desert. And around a third of this earth's surface is desert, right? It's covered in deserts. Now, the original meaning of the word desert is an abandoned place, place where, you know, there's nothing really that's there. And when we look at it, a desert can be what's called, you know, one with sand, but it doesn't have to have sand to be an abandoned place. About only 20% of the deserts on Earth are covered in sand. Other areas are covered in ice and snow. They can be called, you know, a cold desert. It's still the same idea that it's an abandoned place or it's a place where there is nothing. And if you think about that, the largest cold desert is Antarctica. The largest hot desert is the Sahara. You probably already know that in Africa. And that one spans across 12 different countries. Now, when you look at this desert, deserts can be super, like the one in the Sahara, going to have a hot sun and sand. And many times people have gotten lost in the desert or crashed in a desert or wandered in the desert. Some of them find their way out and some don't. It's conditions that are super harsh to live in and super hard to survive in. Now, there's times that we'll encounter in our lives that can only be described as the desert years or wilderness years. And that's the wilderness of the spirit, wilderness of the soul and life. If you think about the hot, the parched, the thirsty, the wandering, the making it out, maybe not making it out, it's the same idea that sometimes in our lives we're going to encounter these things. It could be the death of a loved one. You could lose a job. Your whole world could be shaken up because of that. It could be a betrayal. But the idea is that the waters start rising up around you. They start to envelop you. And I'm not just talking about a little thing here or there. I'm talking about those times when things just overtake your life. These are the times when questions are asked. You wonder why, what's going on? Why are these things happening? And it's not just a small thing I'm talking about. I'm talking about those times that overwhelm us, those times of great stress, those times where, you know, it's like being in a wilderness. You know, there's a progression through going through a wilderness as a spiritual Christian. The worst part of being in a wilderness sometimes when you're in the middle of something like this is it feels like sometimes that God is just not there. And you reach out and you reach out and you wonder, where is God in all of this? And you cry and you wonder where he is. Let's look at Psalm 88, verse 1. Psalm 88, verse 1. David did this and he cried and he wrote it down in the Psalms many times. You know, David was an example of someone who was very, very passionate. He prayed about these things. He thought about them. He expressed them. He talked to God constantly. And he expresses this very concept of being in the desert. Psalms 88, verse 1, it says, "Oh, Lord, God of my salvation, I have cried out day and night before you. Let my prayer come before you. Incline your ear to my cry. For my soul is full of troubles. My life draws near the grave. I am counted with those that go down to the pits. I am like a man who has no strength, adrift among the dead, like the slain who lie in the grave, whom you remember no more, and who are cut off from your hand. You have laid me in the lowest pit, in darkness, in depths." And verse 13 says, "But to you I have cried out, O Lord, and in the morning my prayer comes to you. Lord, why do you cast off my soul? Why do you hide your face from me?" And David expresses this thought. He's in the lowest pit, in the darkness, in the depths, where things feel could seem very, very dark, where the water is over his head like he's in the depths, and he's crying out to God, "And why? Where are you?" And he expresses this very thought. You know, it's during these times when this happens, that we always ask three questions. We always ask certain questions. We ask, why? Why is this happening to me? Why is this going on? We also ask, how long is this going to go on? How long do I have to go through this thing? And then we also ask, and we may not verbalize it, we may not say it out loud, but sometimes we ask, has God left me? Has he forsaken me? Where is God? These are the questions that characterize wandering in a wilderness. When you encounter some things that are so overwhelming in life, when you encounter things that may rise above your head and you see no way out, you start to ask these questions, and then you start to wonder. Not wander in the desert. And wandering is characterized by these questions. by hashing over these questions over and over, they start to play in our mind. Why is this happening? What? When's it going to end? And where is God in all of this? You know, there's a quote from Zora Neale Hurston says, there's years that ask questions and there's years that answer them. And wandering through the wilderness are years of asking the questions. Turn back to Psalm 77, verse 1. You'll see David asks these same three questions. He asks them in different ways. Psalm 77, in verse 1, it says, I cried out to my God with my voice, to God with my voice, and he gave ear to me. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed. Selah. Verse 4, you hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song in the night. I meditate with my heart and my spirit makes diligent search. Verse 7, where's God? It says, will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has his anger shut up his tender mercies? Selah. And you see him asking these questions. He verbalizes them. He writes them down. God has put it into the Bible for us to be able to read, to see that this is a plight and this is what man and how, what we go through at times. When we go through something excruciatingly overwhelming, that we ask the questions, we seek, we wander in the wilderness, we wander in the desert. Turn back to Psalms 13, verse 1. He asks, how long is this going to keep going? Psalms 13, verse 1. It says, how long, O Lord, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take my counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long will my enemy be exalted over me? And we see David grappling with this. And David had to grapple with many things in life. And you can point to his sins and what he had to pay for that, for sure. But he had to deal with so many things that just enveloped him. One of the things that he had to do is he was ordained to be the king. Hey, you are now ordained as our king. And then from there on, he had to be on the run for his life. He had to flee. And they approximate that time to be about 12 years. 12 years of running after you get anointed as the king. And that time was a really incredibly hard time. He's in the wilderness and he had to run from here, go to there. He had to make alliances. He had to, you know, do so many different things that were very, very difficult. That was a big period of trial years that he had to go through. And you see a lot of the Psalms, you'll see were written during those times. And he expresses, yeah, my enemy is, you know, going to catch me. My, you know, he says a lot of these things. And so you see David expressing these same questions when things rose up over his head, when his enemies exalted over him. He asked, where are you, God? How long is this going to be? Where are you? And are you going to cast me off forever? So what we find is there will be these times in life. You know, you don't pray for them, don't ask them on people, but you know, some will have these times in life. And I think we need to ask two questions here. When you are going through one of these times in life, how do we look at this? And two, if you're not going through one of these times in life, how do you help somebody who is? You need both of those things. You know, if we're all just having horrible times at the same time, we wouldn't be able to support each other. But how do you support somebody going through a very, very tough time? And I'm not just talking about, hey, I, you know, somebody yelled at me at work. I'm talking about those times when your life feels like it unravels, when it comes undone. And maybe you haven't been there. And maybe you do know somebody who has, though. How do you support that person? So we need to take a look at this today. Who in the Bible can we think about who would be characterized as going through a wilderness period of time? You know, I don't think anybody in the Bible is embodied being in the wilderness like the man Job in the Bible. You know, and where is God in all of this? Let's go back and pull some things out of the book of Job here for this. Let's turn back to Job 1 verse 1. Job 1 verse 1. Because it's very important to ask and answer the hard questions. There's hard questions you grapple with. And you need to ask them. And you need to answer them from the Bible, because the Bible does, it grapples with these issues. It goes around them and it talks about them and it gives us ways to think and to look at them. And Job is one amazing example that's in the Bible. Job 1 verse 1. Before I start, you know, I let the Bible speak for itself. I know when in years in the past, I always heard people say, you know, Job was self-righteous and this was his sin. And that's absolutely not even correct, because we'll let the Bible speak for what it says here. Job 1 verse 1 says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil." The Bible calls him that. God actually speaks about him this way. He's, you know, these are his words, and he'll say it even later. But Job was a man who was trying to do the right thing. And the idea that he had this hidden sin of self-righteousness and this is what happened is actually what his friends said when he argued with them. And God says that they were wrong. So let's take a fresh set of look at this this story here, because very important. Job was trying and doing the right thing, and he was called righteous. And then verse 2, it says, 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him, and his possessions were, you know, he had a lot of stuff. He had a bunch of sheep and camels and oxen and donkeys and a very large household. And he was great. He was a great man in those days. And verse 4 says, his sons would go to the feast in their house, each on his appointed day, and he would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was when the days of feasting had run their course that Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. So he did that. He even was, hey, let's just, you know, take precautions if even my kids sinned. So in the beginning of this book, everything is the way we think it should be. You know, he's blessed. He's obeying God. He's a righteous man. And look at the blessings God has given to him. You know, God has a whole bunch of, and we read later, you know, there's a hedge about him. God has blessed him. He has been obedient. But wilderness comes suddenly without warning here. Sometimes it comes out of nowhere. You know, I was telling you about Mark Rorum. Can you imagine being on your feet, going through life, and then 2 weeks later fighting for your life without a possible fix? Your life is completely in a different place. All of a sudden, out of nowhere, it comes. And this is what happened here. But what we find here is we tend to think of this as very simplistic. Job had a sin, or he wasn't doing something, or the kids were celebrating birthdays, and this is why all this stuff happened. It's not. The Bible tells us why this happened, because what we find is there's a stage that you and I are participating in life here, but there's a stage in the heavens where other things that are taking place are that we just don't see. We don't know, but we're given a glimpse right here in this book. We're given a glimpse of what happens behind the scenes. You and I encounter things here. We experience things here. But there's something taking place on a different level. That's where God is. And then in the heavens. And we find that, let's go down to verse 6. And this is where we see this taking place. This is Job 1 verse 6. It says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan," so, hey, Satan, you know, where do you come? You know, it's kind of funny because God's in complete control of all this, and Satan's sneaking in. And, you know, the way Satan is, he's never going to be clear and upfront. So God has to poke him and say, hey, kind of see you there, you know. Hey, so where do you come from? What's, you know, what's going on there? What are you doing? And so Satan answered the Lord and he said, well, I'm just, you know, going to and fro on the earth, walking back and forth in it, you know. His language is always this dodging. It's always this misleading. It's always stuff like that, whereas God is very clear. And the Lord said to Satan, well, have you, as you're walking around, since you're just walking around, have you actually considered my servant Job? I think he already knew why he was there. Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on earth. He's a blameless and an upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. So God's very words about the man Job didn't say that he had a hidden sin and he's self-righteous. He said, you know, have you considered my servant Job, that he's blameless, he's upright. He fears God, he shuns evil. And Satan answered the Lord and he said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge about him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. You know, God, you actually putting a blessing on this guy. You got a hedge, right? You're blessing his hands. He's prospering in his work. But verse 11, now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. This is an age-old question. This is an age-old question. We read in the Old Testament that if I obey God, I'll be blessed. If I don't, I'll be cursed. And Satan is, his understanding of why human beings actually worship God, is he is saying to God, the only reason he's actually worshiping you is because you give him stuff. Because you gave him stuff. He's saying that, you know what? If he didn't have all this blessings and this stuff you gave him, he wouldn't worship you at all. Watch. He says, watch. He'll curse you to your face if he loses all of his stuff. Right? And so what we find happens is we have this two scenes that are taking place. And this pattern is given to us, not because this is how it happens every single time, but we see what happens when we see something smack out of nowhere come, we find that something's taking place on a different level here. And we have a privy or an open window to be able to understand and see that up in heaven, there's a dialogue that's taking place, a conversation, and a witness. Do you know that Job's whole life is going to be a witness to the spirit world? It was back then, and now it's written down, and now it's for us today. If you think about this entire process of what's taking place in this book and what's taking place in our lives, it's much bigger than just the way we think about things. Again, we tend to think about things, oh, well, Job must have been disobeying. So something happened, or he had his hidden sin, or this, or some other thing. What we find is we have a challenge here where God is saying, no, this servant of mine is not just all about possessions and just being blessed. So this happened suddenly, and his children all died. And he lost all of his things. And we find, if we go down to verse 20, it says, Job arose, he tore his robe, and he shaved his head, and he fell to the ground, and he worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed is the name of the Lord. In all of this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. You know, his response that he came out with was exactly the opposite of what Satan said that would happen. He said, you know what? God gave me all these things. They were blessings, and God can take them away. Blessed is God. And he didn't sin in all of that. And, you know, Satan thinks that the only reason, you know, we worship God is he's like an ice cream truck. You know, we come by and we get some ice cream every time it comes around, and great. You know, I obey and I get some ice cream and all this good stuff. And that's the only reason why we're doing it, is because we get stuff out of what we're doing and in this relationship we have. You know, this example, though, is instructive of how the wilderness years start and how they come out of nowhere and what sort of dialogue might be going on behind the scenes. For you, don't know what it is. It could be similar. But we are just given a pattern of how it works. There's a stage that we don't see up here, and there's something we experience down here. And those two are really related, very much related. So Satan, well, he tried and he didn't quite, didn't pan out how he thought. So let's go over to chapter 2. He comes back. It says, again, there was a day when the sons of men came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. You know, this picture is great because it also, you know, like I said, it shows God's all powerful here. Satan is, you know, the sons of the sons of God came to present themselves, the angels, and Satan sneaks in. He has to kind of come and present, and he knows he has to submit to the power of God, and so he comes before his throne the same way. But God's the one who's all-powerful here. You never get the impression that it's just, wow, we're on equal footing and just fighting back and forth. God's all-powerful here, which I find a very fascinating picture. And the Lord said to Satan, so where do you come again? So Satan answered the Lord and he said, well, you know, I'm just going to and fro on the earth and I'm walking back and forth on it. He says the same thing again. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there's none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incite me against him to destroy him without a cause. So Satan answered, he said, well, skin, his body. Yes, all that a man has, he'll give for his life. But he'll give up all this stuff. But stretch your hand out now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said, well, behold, he's in your hand, but don't kill him. Do what you can, but don't kill him. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord in verse 7. And he struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took for himself a potsherd, which he used to scrape himself when he sat in the midst of the ashes. Man, this is a very, very, very painful one. The boils all over the body, and you're a place where you're just so uncomfortable, you can't even sit on anything except for in ashes, you know, where fire's burnt out, basically, and something that's, you know, that by the time you get here, you're in a pretty bad spot. I don't know about you if you've ever had anything that's super painful. I used to get poison ivy super bad when I was a teenager. And it used to happen at least one time per year that wherever it was at camp or on canoe trips or wherever I was, I'd get poison ivy. And I remember I would get so bad. I would have the biggest boils all up and down my arms. I had it all between my fingers where I couldn't even close them like this. On my arms, my back, I would just get it so severely bad, and it would last probably a week and a half or so like that. I was absolutely miserable, and I would try and pop them, and I would try and do all kinds of things to help, and nothing helped. It was just the most miserable time. It doesn't even compare to this, but that's the idea. He had things that were just all over his body that he could not get comfortable with, and that's where he's at. He's scraping his skin. He's laying in ashes. Can you imagine being the talk of the town, the, you know, the richest guy around, to then now you're laying in a pile of ashes, scraping yourself? So we see his wife come along, and his wife said to him, you know, verse 9, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die, right? You know, probably not encouraging, but, you know, people dump on the wife, but seriously, she had just lost her entire family and her kids, and this is a time of great stress. So she's expressing that. She's just expressing that out, you know, lost all of her possession, and now her husband looks like he's going to die, and she'll be destitute. You know, back in those days, if you didn't have a husband, a lot of times you're out on the street. So she doesn't, you know what's going on exactly either. In verse 10, he says to her, you know, you speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God? Shall we not accept adversity? And all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. What we find here, though, is we start to see Job's struggle. And that's characteristic of being in a place when you're in a wilderness, is the struggle. Like I said before, I'm not just talking about somebody yelling at your work. I'm talking about when life overwhelms you. This is where the struggle starts to kick in, when you start to hash around these questions, when you start to feel this and you examine what you know about God. And when you're in the wilderness, when you're truly in the wilderness, you struggle, a real struggle. You ask the questions, you wonder, why do I feel alone? Why do I feel abandoned? Now, Job's friends come along. So how do we start to think about this, and how do we actually help those who go through something? Maybe you haven't had a wilderness period in life. How do you help somebody who has? Let's look at Job's friends here. They came along. Chapter 2, verse 11. Job's three friends heard of the adversity that come upon him. Each one came from his own place. Eliphaz, the Temanite, Bildad, the Shuhite, and Zophar, the Naamathite, for they had made an appointment together to come and mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they raised their eyes from afar and did not recognize him, they lifted their voices and wept. And each one tore his robe and sprinkled dust on his head towards heaven. So they sat down with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights. No one spoke a word to him, and they saw that his grief was very great. Man, they couldn't even recognize him. He was, you know, in a very, very bad spot. You know, he was known for his wealth before. Now he's starting to be seen as, you know, in tremendous suffering. And you know what? People may look at you different when you go through the wilderness years. And this is something for us to think about. If somebody's going through tremendously hard times, how do you view that person? Do you feel like, oh, well, maybe they're not being blessed, maybe they're being this, or maybe something's wrong? Or do you see it for what it is, the excruciating pain that they're going through, and what's happening up in the heavenly realm affecting this realm? We don't know exactly what that is, but we know those two things are linked together. But people start to look at you differently. I don't know if you've ever gone through something that's, you know, constantly hard and or bad time and time and time again. You know, it's opposite of what our human nature wants. Our human nature wants heroes and people that are put together and things that go great and wow, what a success story. You know, the hard ones don't give you a great reputation sometimes. And that's for us to think about on a spiritual level, because we need to see this taking place. There's actually something greater than if you just see someone who's blessed and all put together and everything is going fantastic. Because God's involved in that person's life, and what's happening may be massively bigger than we know. But these friends come. You know, they started out right. They didn't say anything for 7 days. That's called Shiva, or the sitting seven. You sit 7 days with somebody, and you mourn with them for an entire week. You know, they started out really well. They started out doing the right thing. When you see someone going in through a wilderness period, and you don't know what to say, don't say anything. You don't have to say something. You know, so many times we want to fix the problem. I don't know about us as guys. Maybe it's just a personality thing. But, you know, when we hear a problem, we want to fix it. Hey, have you tried this? Have you eaten this? Have you done this? We always want to fix something. But don't underestimate the power of just being with somebody. Just showing up. Just being supportive. Don't try to fix it. You don't have to try to fix it. You don't have to have the perfect answer. You can just be with somebody. And they started out right here, right? They started out doing the right thing. His three friends did that. But when they opened their mouths, they undid it all, basically. But they started out right. Think about that, right? They started out with the right thing. Now, what we find is all of this is taking place. Job is holding it together enough. But there's a point where he starts to just struggle and thrash and, you know, you can only hold it together so long. Now you're in all this pain, and then you got people coming to tell you things. You know, it kind of comes to a head. In chapter 3, verse 1, we find the waters finally, as they're up here and he's starting to drown, they go over his head. They pass over. It's too much. And he says in chapter 3, verse 1, he opened his mouth and he cursed the day of his birth. And Job spoke and he said, "May the day perish on which I was born. In the night in which I said, a male child is conceived, may that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor the light shine on it. May darkness and the shadow of death claim it. May a cloud settle on it. May the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, may darkness seize it. May it not rejoice along the days of the year. May it not come into the number of the months. Oh, may that night be barren. May no joyful shout come into it. May those curse it who curse the day. May the stars of its morning be dark. May it look for light, but have none. And the dawning of the, et cetera, et cetera." Can you see the anguish that he's going through? Can you see the angst? Can you see that things have turned dark and gone over his head? So I'm saying the wilderness years are characterized by that. And then you start thrashing. He started thrashing. He started saying all these things. Why did I not die at birth? Verse 11. Why didn't I not perish when it came from the womb? Why did the knees receive me? Why? Why I should have been asleep. I would have been at peace if I hadn't have been born. And you can see him. He opens his mouth. You know what? He's just warming up too. He's just getting started. And this is very important to understand. This is super important to understand when supporting someone, is they may not say things that great. They may not say things that well. They may thrash around. You know what? That's part of going through something that overwhelms you completely. That is part of something that's too much. That is part of the waters reaching over your head as you do start thrashing. You start to try to get some air back. And you know what? A person may say some horrible things. They may say some bad things. They may say some dark things. But we're given an example here of someone who went through this and they were bearing their soul out. A true friend, if you know, even though you're tempted, you won't leave. You won't try to correct every little thing. There's a process here that's taking place. There's a process of going through the wilderness to bear with. You know, it's a time period when things are completely unraveled. Barely breathing. They're passing over your head. You're thrashing about. You're trying to get back up. That's where he's at right here. And what we see now is we see Job, he starts to wander through the wilderness. He starts to what it feels like to wander. What does it feel like to wander, like wander around, lost, aimless, feeling alone, asking those questions I said over and over? Turn to Psalms 102, verse 2. David describes what it's like. David describes what it's like. Psalm 102, verse 2. He says, "Do not hide your face from me in the day of my trouble. Incline your ear to me in the day that I call. Answer me speedily. For my days are consumed like smoke. My bones are burned like a hearth. My heart is stricken and withered like grass that I forget to eat. I don't even remember to eat. Because of the sound of my groaning, my bones cling to my skin. I'm like a pelican of the desert. I'm like an owl of the desert, or a pelican of the wilderness, an owl of the desert. These are animals that are solitary, alone. An owl in the desert. You know, we sing this song. I always remember singing it as a kid, and I always laugh. What does that mean? Like a melancholy sparrow, like a pelican alone. And I would laugh. But, you know, he's describing something that's in solitude. He says, I lie awake. I'm like a sparrow alone on the housetop. I can't sleep. My enemies reproach me all day long. Those who deride me swear an oath against me, for I have eaten ashes like bread and mingled my drink with weeping. Because of your indignation and your wrath, you have lifted me up and cast me away. My days are like a shadow that lengthens, and I wither away like grass. You're stretched. You're maxed. You feel dry. You feel brittle. You feel like breaking. You feel like you can't eat. You can't sleep. This characterizes being in the wilderness. That's what it characterizes. This is how it happens. And David describes it very well, right? That's the feeling of it. Let's go back to Job. Let's see what happened here. What we find is, you know, next 28 chapters, what do we see happening? There's a lot of talk going on here. Job pours out bitterness and confusion about why this is happening. Why to him? What's going on? What is God doing? You know, and what did his friends say to him? They said to him, you must be doing something wrong. God wouldn't just do this. You must be doing something wrong. Job, look at Job 8, verse 4. Job 8, verse 4. They spoke the words, hey, you know what, Job? If your son sinned against God, well, he's cast them away because they did. He killed them because they sinned. And then what do they say to him? Job, why do you hold fast to your integrity? Just admit, you have some hidden thing going on. And they said this over and over. You know, how many times do we think these things? Maybe we don't say them out loud. But how many times do we think them about other people? You know, you must be doing something. That's why you have this. The book of Job gives us a different hope. It shows us there's a realm that's taking place in the spirit world that affects this. And it may not be because of something you did. In the case of Job, God declares him righteous, but still he went through something. Still something happened here. You know, Phil Yancey said, people who make suffering people even worse are Christians usually. That's his quote. He said, Christians are the worst. They make people who are suffering worse. People in the wilderness, you know, need to be encouraged and held and carried. You know, we say things like, well, you know, all you need to do is have faith, or what did you do? Or, you know, what's, you know, and we start going around with this. You and I don't know what's going on in the third heaven for that person. You and I don't know. I actually think, you know, I would stop and think, well, wait, that's happening to them. Is it happening to me? No. I mean, God dealt with Job because he loved him and he worked with him. And God is working with those people that are going through those things. Just see it as a different thing, that there is something taking place that's grand in their life that takes time, that is something big. But we want to look for, hey, are you not obeying? Did you sin or something? Are you doing something wrong? You and I don't know what's going on in the third heaven. We don't know the conversation happening about you. Some people are healed right away. Some are not. Some struggle for a long, long time. You don't know what's going on in the stage in heaven. And Job tells us that. And Job gives us an example that's so clear-cut, you can't argue with it. He was a righteous man. He wasn't doing something wrong. God declared that of him. Yet things happened. Yet he went through this excruciating thing. Job says in chapter 6, verse 14, Job 6, verse 14, he is in anguish, and his friends are starting to pile onto him. And he says, to him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. He is saying, I don't need your moralizing, your comparisons. I need your mercy. Even if it sounds like I am wallowing, I'm turning away from God, I'm saying things that are dark, I need your mercy. Job never said he was without sin. He just said he went from a blessing to the worst nightmare. And he didn't know why. And he's asking of God. And here's where we see him start to struggle and thrash. Chapter 19, verse 6. He's wandering in the wilderness. He says, God has wronged me. Know then that God has wronged me, and he has surrounded me with his net. And then he thrashes again. Verse 25. Well, I know that my Redeemer lives, and he shall stand on the earth. He's coming back. I know I have a Savior. You can see him thrash around, and this thrashing is part of it. It's part of it. And then he goes, chapter 23, verse 3 to 4. This is a natural part too. If I could only make a case, if I could find him, chapter 23, verse 3, if I could find him, I would present a case to him. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. You know, and Job is just saying, boy, God seems distant. I would want to talk to him face to face and to plead my case. And you can see that takes place. This is so many chapters of this, and it's very, very instructive. Now, we find God comes on the scene. And this I find very enlightening, because it's a different response than you think. You know, I expected, you kind of feel like, wow, God seems a little harsh here. He comes on the scene and he doesn't go, hey, sorry, I know this is really hard and all this other stuff. What he does is, let's go to chapter 38, verse 1. God shows up and he starts to answer Job. Job 38, verse 1. And it says, the Lord answered Job out of a whirlwind, and he said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you and you shall answer me. Sounds a little harsh, but you know what? This section of scripture is one of the most encouraging things you could read. You have to read it a few times to get that, but it's one of the most encouraging sections of scripture you could ever read, because you know why? What questions do you and I ask? Why is this happening to me? How long is this going to be? And where is God? Why is he not with me anymore? You know what God does? God puts the right questions in Job's mind. He actually puts the correct questions in his mind, is what he's doing. He's going through a bunch of questions and he sticks those in his brain instead of the three we ask all the time. He says here, verse 4, where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determines its measurement? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? And who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sank together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? So it feels like an odd response, like he's ignoring all the stuff that's going on with Job. He didn't sit there and start empathizing. What he's doing is he's giving Job a different frame of reference to life, to God, to his relationship, to the purpose, to the meaning, to everything. And where does he start? You couldn't start bigger than this. You couldn't start with, do you know how the earth was created? Do you know how big the universe is? You know, we estimate how we think big the universe is, and we're wrong. We estimate how many stars there are, 10 with 29 zeros after it, and we're wrong. We still don't even know. We try to measure things in light speed. We try to figure out how big it is, and we still don't know. And God says, do you even know how big the universe is? Job obviously couldn't answer that. We think we're closer to answering that. We're so far off. We have no clue. We have a clue, but we have no clue really how big it really is. And God is saying, who understands how big this universe is? Who laid the foundations of it? Who stretched it? Who put this together? Let's start there. A person that's in your life, the person you're speaking to and about, is the person who started with that. And he starts to bring his brain to a different spot. And that's why I think these sets of scriptures are super, super encouraging when you go through some of the hardest things in life. And let's drop down to verse 25. Who's divided a channel for the overflowing water, or a path for the thunderbolt, to cause it to rain on a land when there is no one, in a wilderness in which there is no man, to satisfy the desolate waste and cause it to spring forth the growing of tender grass? You know, he's starting to talk about the weather and the rain and things like that. But you know what he's also doing here? And you'll see this theme. Is he saying, do you know what? Why would we rain on a place where there is nobody, the desert? Why would we do that? There's no man there. There's no nothing. The waste place causes it to spring forth in grass. Seems like a waste. But what God is pointing out to him is that this is just how God is. He waters everything and everybody, whether there's a person there or not. He even satisfies the desert in a desolate place. And that's the very language of being in a desert and being watered is something that he is pointing out here to Job. He's showing him, hey, you know what? I can water, and I do water desolate and desert places. It seems like a waste, but it's saying that God is just good. He just does this. It's not because you did something great or didn't do something great. God is just good in what he does. No matter if there's a person there or not, or a desert or anything, this is the way, the nature of God. You can start to relax in this and see that God is showing him that he feeds, he creates, and he nurtures all his creation. And then he says in chapter 39, verse 1, do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time they bear their young? They bow down, they bring forth their young, they deliver their offspring. Their young ones are healthy, they grow strong with grain, they do depart and do not return to them. And he's saying, there's a process of life. Do you know how that works? I'm the one who created these things, and I'm the one who gives them grain, and I'm the one who provides for them, and I'm the one who waters the earth. Verse 5, who set a wild donkey free, who loosed the bonds of an onager, whose home I have made the wilderness, and the barren land its dwelling. He scorns the tumult of the city. He does not heed the shouts of the driver. The range of the mountains is his pasture, and he searches after every green thing. Food again. He's given food. Can you bind? Will the wild ox be willing to serve you? Will he bed by your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in furrow with ropes? Or will he plow the valleys behind you? Will you trust him because his strength is great? Will you leave your labor to him? Will you trust to bring home your grain and gather it in your threshing floor? God made all of these things, and God is pointing this out to Job. These are the questions to ponder and to think about. Who do I know how even a deer is born? How does something get its food? How big is the earth? How does the cycle of being fed? Oh, all of these creatures are fed. They're all provided for. When you start to think about what God, the question he's putting into Job's mind, he's giving him a totally different place to think about. God is good to everything, and to every creature, and to the earth, even when there's a desert, and nothing. Verse 13, the wings of an ostrich wave proudly, but her wings are pinions like kindly storks, for she leaves her eggs in the ground and warms them in dust. She forgets that a foot may crush them, or the wild beast may break them. She treats her young harshly as though they were not hers. Her labor is in vain without concern, because God deprived her of wisdom, and he did not endow her with understanding. That's awesome. He created a goofy bird, God is saying. I created a goofy bird. It's got no brains. I didn't give it wisdom. He sticks the eggs in the ground and it's, you know, doesn't treat them well. And it's just a kind of a dumb bird is what God's saying. But I even take care of that. I even take care of that type of a bird. And then he goes on to a different animal, chapter 40, verse 15. Look at the behemoth. and there's different ideas of what this actually means, but the thought is that this is actually a hippopotamus. Look at the behemoth which I make along with you. He eats grass like an ox. See now his strength is in his hips and his power in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar and the sinews of his thigh are tightly knit. His bones are like beams of bronze and his ribs like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Only he made him can bring bring near his sword. Surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play there. He lies under the lotus trees in the covert of the reeds in the marsh, in the water. The lotus trees cover him with their shade. The willows by the brook surround him. Indeed, the river may rage, yet he's not disturbed. He's competent, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth. One of his tremendous beasts that he created, and God is just saying, look, I provide for even that. I have a dumb ostrich. I have one of the most magnificent beasts. And hippopotamuses actually are quite dangerous. They can move. They're so muscular. I don't know if you've ever seen them. I've seen them in Africa before. So muscular. And a lot of people actually get killed by them because they're such a powerful beast. And that's what he's saying. This is a powerful beast. He eats the grass. But yet there's food for him. And I provide for all of my creatures. They're fed. They're watered. It's not because they did something great or did something wrong. God provides and he is just this way. And what we find is that God gives this discourse and the magnitude of what he is, how he's like, how he treats his creation. And he's kind of saying to Job, you know, it's like he says, what did Christ say in the New Testament? Where can you think about, hey, I take care of the animals. Why wouldn't I take care of you? Right? Doesn't Christ quote that? You know, I feed the grass, clothe the grass of the field. Or I feed the sparrows, or not one falls, or one head of your hair falls. Like he's saying to Job, I can take care of any of this in just a heartbeat. And to the God that you that I am, I take care of all of these things and I can do this. And what Job finally learned is he stopped asking the question, why is this happening to me? You know what? God didn't answer that for him. You notice that? God didn't tell him all that. You're not going to get the answer why so many times. You're not going to get the why. Someday you will. Job didn't give it to him. He was given a different set of questions to think about. He didn't get the why. He didn't get the how long it's going to be either. But Job turned in chapter 42, verse 5. He says, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and ashes. Right? And he repented. He saw God. He saw clearly God. He stopped, you know, feeling, oh, why me? Woe is me? And all the other things, how hard this is. And he says, you know what? I've heard of you. Now I really see what you're like. And it was in verse 7 that after the Lord spoke these things that he said to his friends, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you've not spoken to me what is right, as my servant Job has. He wasn't just trying to hold to his dignity. He was saying, God doesn't work like that. He isn't just somebody sins and he punishes them, or I've got some hidden sin. That's not why this is taking place. And God backed up Job, said, no, sorry, your friends are wrong. And you know what? In verse 8, you know, he made them sacrifice and go to your servant Job and offer it for them. And my servant shall pray for you, and I will accept him, lest I deal with you according to your folly. Because you've not spoken to me what is right, as my servant Job has. This is important to God. You and I to speak correctly of God to other people that are going through a wilderness period. That's how important that is. He said, I'm mad at you. And he did not let it go until Job prayed for his friends. The one who received the short end of the stick from them turned around and prayed for them. He took something. He took a hit to make peace here and to say, forgive them, God. I forgive them. Even though that was super hard and harsh. And that's when God forgave them. Now, he didn't get the answers. Why is this happening? How long? He didn't get those. God put his brain somewhere else. And this, to me, is so instructive. If you're ever going through the hardest of time, start with Job 38 and go through 42 and just read it and think about what God is saying for you to think about. Totally different thing. Totally different thing. And so I think it's actually super encouraging to read those things. Because you can relax. You go, I know the God who actually laid the foundations of this earth, who can birth a deer, who can feed wherever and makes it rain anywhere it needs to. Could God in a second change where you're at? That's what confidence it gives you. It puts your brain in the right place that, yes, God could change the circumstance in a heartbeat. I don't know what's going up on the heavenly realm, but it's affecting this realm, and we're going to go through this, but this is the faith in the God and what type of a God he is. That's where he put Job's brain. Not, sorry, you're feeling bad, and, you know, oh, this is why it happened, and all these things. He put it in the right place. Because you're not going to know. You're not going to know. Did his wilderness years end? Yes. Job 42:12. He blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. He had 14,000. He had a whole bunch more now. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and he called the name of the first, Jenema. The name of the second, Kiziah. And the name of the third, Karen Hapak. And in the land were found no women so beautiful as the daughters of Job. And their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. And after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his children and his grandchildren for 4 generations. So he died old and full of age. Did his wilderness years end? Yes, they did. Yes, they did. And it wasn't answering a question why it happened or how long, but that it was brought to a relationship that was much deeper, much more faith. And God put the blessing back. He restored it. And what's very interesting is the boys' names aren't even mentioned here, right? He calls out the girls' names. Not only that, I mean, that doesn't happen back in those days. It's always the men and the inheritance. And guess what? Not only are the girls, his daughters, mentioned by name, but they also got an inheritance. You know what Job took on? The same nature as God that he just learned about. Hey, I make it rain on all of my creatures. We're not some better, some not. I make it rain on wherever. And he honored the women here, the beautiful creatures that God had created. That was against the systems of the day in the cultures back then. And he called it out. God says, I even love my ostrich who's not that smart. And that's how women were seen a lot of times. And guess what nature Job took on? He's changed to what God is. And he honored all of his creatures. And he gave them an inheritance. So he learned how God was. It's a really interesting example here. He learned so much more. Now I see you. Wow, I didn't see how you deal with us. It's not just because I did something well and I got blessed. No, and now, you know, it wasn't just what Satan said and it wasn't his friends. You had a sin. He saw God deeper. God brought him through this and they were given an inheritance and everything else here. So some of you are suffering. Why? Don't know. How long will it last? I don't know. Does your response matter? Sure. But one thing we know, that God left the upper stage. He came down to the lower stage to die for you and die. And if he's going to do that, and you're going to go through something excruciating, you have to know that God is there, just as he was here with Job every step of the way. Where is God in the wilderness? He's closer than you think. He's closer than you think. Why is this happening to me? It's the wrong question. You don't know, and you probably won't know. One day God will talk with you about it, but you have to know that all things work together for the good of those who love God. When will it end? I don't know. But again, it's the wrong question. It says, wait on the Lord, be of good courage, and he'll strengthen your heart. Wait, I say on the Lord, wait. And we ask, has God forsaken me? Why has God forsaken me? Again, where is God in this? He's there every step of the way. He led ancient Israel through the wilderness. He fed them. He clothed them. He even said they lacked nothing. Their clothes didn't wear out. You know what? It was a hard, hard time in the wilderness. But I actually, their feet didn't swell. I took care of little details like that. Their clothes didn't wear out and their feet didn't swell. What strange things to bring out, even though you're going through this hard time. But that's very indicative of how God is. God is right there every step, even though you're going through the wilderness and it doesn't feel like he's right there. So we will sometimes encounter a wilderness period in life. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you will one day, and it'll be difficult. It'll be very difficult. But is it doing something to punish us, to harm us? It's not. We're going to go through a wilderness time. How do you be with those who are? You know what? It's just being there for people is all you need to do. You help somebody. Did you make a meal for somebody? You help somebody clean? You help do anything that is for somebody? Just being there. Not telling them what their sins are, not telling them why, or not trying to, you know, find a reason for it. God won't always tell us a reason for it himself. So let's not try to guess it sometimes. But know that this is taking place up here for a bigger purpose, and it affects things down here. And it's very much God involved in a deliberate thing. And we'll find one day that one day God will heal all of this. You know, let me just one last point here. You know, it says, don't think it's strange concerning the fiery trial, right? But rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings. When his glory is revealed, you may be glad with exceeding joy. Those sufferings and those wilderness periods are not for zero. There's a purpose. If we participate in the sufferings because of God's involved in our life and because of this, when he comes back, you will be glad with exceeding joy. You know, it's like that story of the little red hen. Participating in his sufferings is the same way. The little red hen was baking some bread. And he said, hey, who, you know, can help me measure out the flour? And all of them sat around and said, not I, not I, not I. Who can add some water and help me mix it? Oh, not I, not I, not I. Who can put some baking soda in and help me? Not I, not I, not I. Oh, who can, you know, let's knead this dough, mash it. Who can help me? Not I, not I. And then she put it and took it into the oven, put it in the oven. It came out bread. And he said, who wants to help me eat this? And everybody says, oh, I do. And it's the same idea. Christ says, you know, there may be sufferings that take place. And we have to be willing to go through those, because when the glory is revealed, we may be glad with exceeding joy. We say, you know, I am willing to, because what's to come is even greater than that. One day, let's finish with Isaiah 51:3. Isaiah 51, verse 3. That desert, that wilderness, that feeling, that aloneness, all of those things, just know that God will heal your heart one day. It will be healed. Isaiah 51 verse 3, for the Lord will comfort Zion, comfort his church. He will comfort all her waste places. He will make her wilderness like Eden and her desert like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found in it, thanksgiving and a voice of melody. The exact opposite of the stretched, the thin, the not sleeping, the being alone. There will be a healing. You may have wilderness years. Let's do two things. Let's help others going through them. Don't moralize or blame, but just be there. And let's ask the right questions of God and put our minds on the amazing way that God is, so that we may see how he is and read through Job 38 to the end.